While we are sort of getting to the PowerPoint, I'd like to start with a caveat. That is, unlike a number of eminent colleagues who have kindly accepted to take part in this conference, such as the ones that you've already heard in the discussion time, I'm by no means a specialist in the India-China interface, and my presentation is not intended to break new ground, but only to look back to a much controverted issue which happens to be at the core of our topic today, that is on intersecting universalities. Thank you. Merci. My starting point, my paper is entitled Is Zhongguo the Middle Kingdom or Madhya Desh? So my starting point will be a sentence which sounds rather intriguing to me, as it has done so far to a good number of scholars, so here I'm certainly not breaking new ground. So it's a sentence from Fa Xian's, who lived around 337 to 422 of the Christian era. So Fa Xian is this Chinese Buddhist monk who wrote this Fo Guo Ji, notes on the country of the Buddha, which was first translated about two centuries ago into a European language, namely French, by Jean-Pierre Abel Remusat, who lived from 1788 to 1832. So Jean-Pierre Abel Remusat was this self-taught sinologist who was elected some 200 years ago on the very first chair dedicated to Chinese studies ever created in Europe. And that was in 1814 at the Collège de France, then called the Collège Royal, here in Paris, in this very spot. As it happens, the Fo Guo Ji has recently been translated afresh into French by one of our eminent colleagues, Jean-Pierre Drège, as the first volume dedicated to Buddhist studies within a bilingual Chinese-French collection I have just mentioned. And here it is, so Fa Xian, Mémoires sur les pays bouddhiques. So the Fo Guo Ji is the narrative assigned to that Buddhist monk, who, with a few other monks, embarked on what would turn out to be a 15-year pilgrimage, or rather quest, to use Timothy Barrett's term, to India between 399 and 414, with a view to bringing back to China some manuscript versions of Vinaya texts, that is, texts on the Buddhist monks' discipline in the Hinayana tradition, that is the ancient Buddhist tradition. And here you have again a map which completes the one that you've seen with Béatrice Laridon's presentation. So you've got what was left on the left-hand side of the map. China is here, you know, out of the map on the right. Fa Xian took the whole trip, you know, from China to this part of India, which you have on the northern part of the map. And here we will revert to this later. So this is let me see. I lost my text anyway. Anyway, so this is the opening sentence of the Fuguoji. Fa Xian was living of old in Chang'an, which was the capital of Wei China, deploring the lacunae and imperfections of the collection of texts on discipline, that is Vinaya, in the first year of the Hongshi era, which was the cyclical year Yihai, that is the year 399 of the Christian era. He, that is Fa Xian, together with Hui Jing, Dao Zheng, Hui Ying, Hui Wei, and others, took the joint engagement to go to Tianzhu, that is that was one of the terms used to designate India as a whole, and seek for the precepts and the discipline. So the sentence which caught my attention in Fa Xian's narrative runs as follows in the original Chinese, and I'm really a bit annoyed. Oh yes, here it is. So the first paragraph is the first sentence of the Fuguoji, which I've just read in translation, and the second paragraph is this one. After crossing the river, so Fa Xian and his companions came to the country of Wuchang, that is Udiana. Udiana is really in North India, that is Bei Tianzhu. The people all use the language of Central India, Zhong Tianzhu. So Central India, Zhong Tianzhu, is what is called the central country, Zhongguo. The food and clothes of the common lay people are the same as in the Zhongguo, central country. The law of the Buddha there is most flourishing. So the term Central India in Chinese, Zhong Tianzhu, was premised upon the spatial construction that divided India into five regions: the northern, southern, eastern, western, and middle. Middle, the middle, being in Buddhist times where the Buddha was born. And here you have the this part of present-day India, which is Buddha land, you see, in the northeastern part of India. So the whole question of that sentence, which I've just read, revolves around the meaning of the Chinese expression which you have in red, 中国, which recurs twice in the sentence, and which literally means middle or central country, but which in a Chinese context would automatically be taken to mean the middle kingdom, that is China. So the question is therefore whether the Chinese designation 中国 in this quote, and more particularly in the second occurrence, refers to China, or whether it simply means a central country, in which case it would have to be understood as a literal translation of the Sanskrit Madhya Desh, that is the middle country. So in her discussion of this question, Janine Nicol, who is a disciple of Professor Barrett here, and who teaches at SOAS London, definitely opts for the latter reading and for the following translation. So I read Janine Nicol's translation. Udiana is truly in North India. All the people of this place use the language of Central India. Central India is that which is called the central state. So in Chinese, 中国, in Sanskrit, Madhya Desh. The dress and food and drink of the ordinary people in Udiana, that is in North India, are the same as those in the central state. And Janine Nicol, you know, chooses to understand the Chinese 中国 as Madhya Desh. So according to her, I quote, this section has been misinterpreted by some, and not of the least, and she quotes from Professor Tan Sen Sen, from Professor Max Daeg and Professor Jonathan David Felt, to suggest that the people of the Madhya Desh had the same habits as those of China, Zhongguo. This can probably be traced back to James Legge's ambiguous translation, which is Central India being what we should call the Middle Kingdom. The food and clothes of the common people are the same as in that central kingdom. So in his authoritative book, dated 2003, Buddhism, Diplomacy and Trade, Professor Tan Sen Sen gives the following interpretation. I quote, India's unique status in the Chinese world order can be discerned, for example, from Li Daoyuan's commentary, which dates back to the 6th century. So his commentary to the 3rd century work, Shui Jing, the water classic. Based on the Chinese pilgrim Fa Xian's notice on Middle India, Li Daoyuan writes, from here, that is northern India, to the south, all the country is Madhyada. That is in Chinese, Zhongguo. Its people are rich. The inhabitants of Madhya Desh dress and eat like the Middle Kingdom. And in parentheses, you have Zhongguo, that is China. Therefore, they are called Madhya Desh. So here we have, you know, we will have Professor Sen's comment on this, but. Anyway, Janine Nichols then goes on to explain, I quote, other translators have hedged their bets by using a literal translation without explanation. For example, Samuel Beale. Only Abel Remusa, you know, our French Abel Remusa, and recently Haiyan Hu von Hinhuber, treat the second instance of Zhongguo in this passage as referring to Madhya Desh. Given the context, the author has just mentioned the language Uvdiana, and the habits of the people of Madhya Desh are discussed in a later passage and sound nothing like those of China. Therefore, Janine Nichols says, I follow Remusa and Hu von Hinhuber. End of quote. So it may be useful to be reminded of Abel Remusat's French translation, the first, as we have seen, into a European language. Quand on a passé le fleuve, on est dans le royaume d'Uchang. Ce royaume d'Uchang forme précisément la partie septentrionale de l'Inde. On y fait absolument usage de la langue de l'Inde centrale. L'Inde centrale est ce qu'on nomme royaume du milieu. Les habillements du peuple et sa manière de se nourrir sont aussi semblables à ceux du royaume du milieu. And in a footnote, Abel Remusa makes the following explanatory comment. Le royaume du milieu, dans le texte Zhongguo, comme c'est précisément l'expression dont on se sert pour désigner communément la Chine, il faut prendre garde dans les relations bouddhiques à ne pas confondre les passages qui se rapportent à la Chine avec ceux qui sont relatifs aux contrées de Mathura, de Magadha et autres royaumes situés dans l'Inde centrale. Cette confusion ne peut avoir lieu dans le livre de Shi Fa Xian, qui, en parlant de son pays natal, le désigne toujours par les noms de dynasties, Han, Qin, etc. And in a similar fashion, Jean-Pierre Drège, so the later translator, translates Zhongguo in a very non-committal way as le royaume du milieu, but without making any explicit comment. So the gist of the matter here is therefore a highly controversial and contested notion of centrality. Whereas by the 4th century of the Christian era, 中国 would in Chinese unequivocally designate the Chinese idea of its own centrality, be it geographical, political, or cosmological, it appears that in Faxian's narrative, the expression would be used to translate the Sanskrit term for central northern India, Madhya Desh, the sphere of operation of the Buddha. So ancient Indian sources seem to offer varying definitions of Madhya Desh. In a note on the middle country of ancient India, dating 1904, T.W. Rhys-Davids starts by observing that any place in the world tends to consider itself as the center of the world. Thus, I quote, the Chinese are often reported habitually to speak of China as the middle country. It is difficult to say whether this last is a designation merely geographical or whether it also connotes that the people outside are outsiders or barbarians, those barbarians that have been a topic of much discussion already. And I do not know if any Chinese scholar has adequately discussed the history and full bearing of the term. But it is interesting to notice that certain writers in India made use of a similar expression. And Rhys-Davids then traces, I quote, the oldest use of the phrase in the Brahmin books in Manu, which says, that country which lies between the Himalaya and the Vindhya mountains, to the east of the destruction and to the west of Prayaga, is called the middle country, Madhya Desh. End of quote. So, 3 decades later, that is in the 1930s, Birmala Chumlo, the author of A Historical Geography of Ancient India, examines the notion of Madhya Desh in Sanskrit Buddhist sources. And I quote, as in the Pali text, so in the Sanskrit Buddhist text as well, Madhya Desh is the country that is elaborately noticed. Its towns and cities, parks and gardens, lakes and rivers have been mentioned time and again. Its villages have not also been neglected. It seems, therefore, that the middle country was exclusively the world in which the early Buddhists confined themselves. It was an eastern district of the Madhya Desh that Gautama became the Buddha, and the drama of his whole life was staged on the plains of the middle country. So I was trying here to show you the Buddha land. He traveled independently or with his disciples from city to city and village to village, moving as it were within a circumscribed area. The demand near home was so great and insistent that he had no occasion during his lifetime to stir outside the limits of the middle country. And as early Buddhism is mainly concerned with his life and the propagation of his teaching, Buddhist literature that speaks of the times, therefore, abounds with geographical information, mainly of the Madhya Desh, within the limits of which the first converts to the religion confined themselves. The border countries and kingdoms were undoubtedly known and were often visited by Buddhist monks, but those of the distant south or northwest seem to have been known only by names handed down to them by traditions. So, end of quote. It would seem, therefore, that in Indian Buddhist sources, Madhya Desh would be tantamount to the country where the Buddha was born, lived, and attained parinirvana. This central country is often described in highly favorable terms in Buddhist sources. According to Birmala Chumlo, this is how some prominent places in Madhya Desh, which are still identifiable in present-day Bihar, which is in the northeastern part of India, are characterized. And here I quote, Vaishali was a great city, which you have here on the slide, Vaishali, was a great city of the Madhya Desh and is identical with modern Bisar in the Muzaffarpur district of Bihar. The city, which resembled the city of the gods, was at the time of the Buddha happy, proud, prosperous and rich, with abundant food, charming and delightful, crowded with many and various people, adorned with buildings of various descriptions, storied mansions, buildings and palaces with towers, noble gateways, triumphal arches, covered courtyards, and charming with beds of flowers in her numerous gardens and groves. So these distinctively laudatory descriptions are corroborated by Fa Xian's testimony, unless, of course, it is to be assumed that he was completely under the influence of the rhetoric inherited from the Indian traditions and vehicled, you see, by his colleagues, his in the Indian Buddhist monks. So in the Fo Guo Ji, the central country, that is Madhya Desh, in Chinese Dongguo, is repeatedly described as an ideal kingdom. So you have the first quote, the first paragraph. South from this, it is called the central country, Zhongguo, again in red. In the central country, the cold and heat are in harmony, there being neither frost nor snow. The people are numerous and happy. There is neither household registration nor the laws of officials. Only those who plow the lands of the king need hand over part of their profits in tax. If one wishes to go, one can go. If one wishes to stay, one can stay. The king governs without having to resort to decapitation. Criminals are only punished with a fine, which will be light or heavy depending on the offense. Even in the case of repeatedly planning wicked rebellion, the offender will only have his right hand cut off. No more. The king's attendants and guards of his entourage all have a salary. Throughout the whole country, the people do not kill any living being, nor do they drink alcohol, nor eat onions or garlic. The sole exception is the Chandala. Chandala is the name for bad people. They live apart from others. Whenever they enter a city or a marketplace, they strike a piece of wood to mark their difference. People then know and avoid them so as not to come into contact with them. In that country, they do not raise pigs nor poultry, and animals are not sold while alive. In the markets, there are no butchers or alcohol dealers. In buying and selling, they use cowrie shells. Only the Chandala fish, hunt, and sell meat. So here, you must bear in mind, you see, what these annotations would mean to a Chinese mind, you see. For example, you know, not resorting to decapitation, not, you know, taxing the people heavily, and also allowing people to go freely, you know, to go and stay freely. If you think of a Chinese system that was put in place in ancient times and is still in a way valid in modern China, in modern day China, you have this famous hukou system, which would, you know, sort of make sure that the people don't, you know, precisely stay or go as they wish, you see. So here you have a sort of ideal country that is central India. Fa Xian further describes Pataliputra, present-day Patna, the capital city of Bihar, as a thoroughly ideal kingdom, the depiction of which would even go beyond anything imaginable in the mind of the wisest Confucian sage. I mean, Béatrice Laridon opened the session this morning by talking about, the utilization of quotes from the Confucian Analects in a Buddhist context, you see. And here you have something that, sounds very Confucian. That's the second paragraph here. The cities and towns of this kingdom are the greatest of all in the central country. Again, Zhongguo in red. The inhabitants are rich and prosperous and vie with one another in the practice of 人意, that is, you have the expression here, 人意. This is cardinal expression in Chinese, which would be two of the cardinal Confucian virtues, meaning benevolence and righteousness. So here it's interesting to have, you know, in Chinese Buddhist monks' annotation about an Indian Buddhist country, you know, those very Confucian terms. The heads of the Vaishya families establish in the cities houses for dispensing charity and medicines. All the poor and destitute in the country, orphans, widowers, and childless men, maimed people and cripples, and all of who are diseased, go to those houses and are provided with every kind of help, and doctors examine the diseases. They get the food and medicines which their cases require and are made to feel at ease, and when they are better, they go away of themselves. Okay, so this is, you know, an ideal country with sécurité sociale, in a way, you know, avant la lettre. So, as was noted by Abel Rémusat, Fa Xian seems to take it for granted that the Chinese designation Zhongguo can only refer to Madhya Desh, which is confirmed by the fact that he and his fellow monks consistently refer to themselves as coming from the borderlands, the biandi, literally the lands of the margins, implicitly designating Madhya Desh as the only possible central country or kingdom, that is Zhongguo. And as Abel Rémusat specified in his footnote, the Chinese monks never use Zhongguo to refer to their homeland, but persistently identify themselves as coming from the land of such and such a Chinese dynasty. For example, the land of Qin, Qin Di, the land of Han, Han Di, or the land of Jin, Jin Di, Jin being the Chinese reigning dynasty at the time of Fa Xian. So, for instance, you have the first paragraph. From there, Fa Xian walked eastwards for 3 days and across the river Sindh, that's the Indus River. The ground is flat on either side. After crossing the river, there was a country called Pitu. The law of the Buddha was very flourishing, and both the Mahayana and the Hinayana were studied by the monks. When these monks saw the monks from Qin walking by, they were moved with great pity and compassion and uttered these words. How is it that these men from a borderland, Biandi, could have learned to become monks, literally to leave their families and to practice the way and travel such a long distance to seek for the law of the Buddha? So the Indian monks supplied the Chinese with what they needed and treated them in accordance with the rules of the Buddhist law. So in this passage, Fa Xian and his companions are identified or identify themselves as coming from Qin, which refers to both the short-lived dynasty which founded the first centralized empire in 221 BC, and to the later Qin dynasty under which Fa Xian was born. So it is worth noting that Qin is probably the origin of the Sanskrit transliteration China, which in turn was transliterated as China in a number of European languages. So we come to the second paragraph here. When Fa Xian and Dao Zheng arrived at the famous Jetavana monastery where the Buddha had lived for a long time, they felt their borderland status even more acutely. So this is the quote. When Fa Xian and Dao Zheng first arrived at the Jetavana Vihara, they reminisced how in the past the world-honored one, the Shizun, that is the Buddha, had resided there for 25 years. They reproached themselves for being born in a borderland, Biandi. Along with their like-minded companions, they had traveled through so many countries. Some had returned home and some were no more. And here they were, contemplating the Buddha's place left vacant and feeling inexpressibly sad at heart. At that moment, a crowd of monks came out and asked Fashian and the others, "What country have you come from?" They replied, "From the land of Han, Handi." The monks exclaimed with a sigh, "How strange that men of a borderland should come as far as here to seek the law." They said to one another, "In the whole succession of our teachers and fellow monks, we have never seen any monks from Han coming here." So the text here specifies that Fashian and Daozheng reproached themselves for being born in a borderland. And I would quote Professor Barrett again here, who explains, I quote, "For flying in the face of a predominant Chinese cultural chauvinism, these men insisted on accepting Indian rather than Chinese claims to the title of Central Kingdom. This was no easy transfer of allegiance. As one of Xuanzang's contemporaries makes clear," we'll hear more about Xuanzang later, "in discussing the controversial question to the true Buddhist of the peripheral position of Chinese civilization, it entailed an acceptance of an implicit spiritual inferiority for all Chinese, since personal karmic forces were held to determine not only one's own station in life, but also the whole environment in which one found oneself. To have witnessed the Buddha's own preaching in India was a sure sign of past spiritual effort. To live in China a millennium later was itself an indictment for past failings." So it wasn't just a matter of being born, you know, far away from Buddha land, but it was also a sign that your karma was really not the right one. So the central country is so idealized and the despair of being born elsewhere is such that Fashian's fellow pilgrim, Daozheng, decides squarely not to return to the land of Han, that wretched borderland, and he squarely decides to remain in India. And that's the third and last paragraph you have on the slide. So Fashian stayed there, that is in Pataliputra, present-day Patna, for 3 years, learning the Indian writing and language and copying the Vinaya. When Daozheng arrived in the central country, that is Zhongguo, again in red, Madhya Desh, and saw for himself the rules of the law of the Shramana, that is the monks, and the dignified demeanor of the monks, which he could observe in all circumstances, he deploringly recalled the borderland of Qin, with the lacunary and faulty precepts and discipline practiced by the monks there. He thereupon took the oath, "From this time forth until I reach the state of Buddha, I vow not to be reborn in a borderland." He consequently remained in India and never returned to China. As to Fashian, whose original intention it was to make the precepts and the discipline widely available in the land of Han, he went back there alone. So we witness here a radical parting of the ways between the two monks from the land of Han. Daozheng was convinced that central northern India, the very place where the Buddha had lived, was the only place where one could stand a chance of achieving Buddhahood, or at least of accumulating merit in that respect through successive rebirths. On the other hand, Fashian did not deviate from his initial purpose, the one for which he had set out on that long and perilous journey, namely bring back the authentic texts and rituals of the Vinaya from the land of Buddha to the borderland that was China, and thereby provide a chance for awakening and enlightenment to the Chinese who were not lucky enough to be born in the right place. So in Fashian's narrative, and I will conclude here, as well as in many other texts associated with Chinese Buddhist monks, the repeated references to central India as being the land of the Buddha and as being consequently the only possible central country, pushing China very far on the margins, have led to the celebrated diagnosis by the regretted Antonino Forte of a borderland complex, of which Fa Xian was by no means the first representative, but by all means a particularly acute case. Fa Xian's case of the borderland complex, once placed in its context, appears to represent one particular stage in a long evolving process which was still to reach a climax with the subsequent batch of famous Chinese monks who took the road to India over 200 years later and who also visited the central country, that is Xuanzang, about whom Professor Sen is going to talk presently, and Yi Jing. And as was noted by Antonino Forte, the borderland complex, I quote, could only be solved by showing that China too was a sacred land of Buddhism, a task which China would undertake in the centuries following Xuanzang's quest, and which would be tantamount to, as I said, a massive overhaul of Buddhism from its original land, that is India, to new borderlands, that is China. And thank you for your attention, and we'll open the discussion right away. Thank you.